Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this next segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Karen Mahar from Camp Sundown. So tell me a little bit about Camp Sundown.
Camp Sundown is a unique-to-the-world night program for children who can't be in daylight. And they come with their families. It's a whole family experience. They spend a week with us, and they really bond over their common situation of not being able to be out in the sunlight.
So what's the condition responsible?
We started the camp in 1996 for kids that had xeroderma pigmentosum, XP, which is what our daughter had. And there was no support group in the world, no gathering of information, just a small little article in a pediatric dermatology journal that talked about how depressing this life would be. And it was just so very upsetting that my husband and I decided to start it for kids with XP. But as we went on and found out that that number itself is so small of people who have that condition, there were more kids that weren't able to go to a regular summertime day program who wanted a place to go, and they had light sensitivity issues that were extreme and severe and life-threatening, just like XP, maybe not as severe, but limiting, certainly. So we opened it up to other cases of children with porphyria, children with solar urticaria, polymorphous light eruption, all these other conditions we had never, ever heard of before.
So how has the community responded over time to making this available?
I think because I grew up in the area where we started the first camp. I knew all the neighbors. I grew up with their kids. We had immediate support from friends and family and local people who had known us as a family for years. And I think that was really, really key to it taking off. And as it began to grow, and this is our 24th year, we got more attention throughout the whole globe because families were coming in from every country you can imagine. So there was Reuters, and there was all the international news, which then brought in more local news. So I think it really took off from starting with that community base.
So what are some of the challenges in putting together a program for those with light sensitivity issues?
Actually, I think because we lived with the condition, we knew what needed to be done, and those almost were second nature for us, tinting windows and making sure all the lights were incandescent or now LEDs, that there was no halogen or fluorescent type of lighting that would emit ultraviolet radiation like the sun. Those were just situations we knew to live with, so we just knew to do that stuff right away. I think our biggest challenge was getting activities that we could go to at night that would actually be open at the hours that these kids could go out and the type of lighting that they would have. Even at night, outdoor lighting can sometimes be a hazard.
So you mentioned your daughter had it. Can you tell me a little bit about the diagnosis process?
Yes. Our daughter Katie was diagnosed with a severe light sensitivity, and we then went up and down the East Coast trying to find out what this condition was and what to avoid so that she could live healthy. She had 8 third-degree burns before she was a year and a half. In just normal situations where you might be in the kitchen and open the window a little bit, well, the rays through that little bit of the window would cause a radiation burn on her arm, I mean, situation so unique and severe that the process of getting her diagnosed was exactly the same. Severe.
So,
and in this whole up and down the East Coast, they started with the most common conditions. Was it a chemical thing that reacted with the sunlight? Was it a lotion? Was it something she was allergic to? Until finally we went through, I think it was the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, a tiny little office down in Bethesda, Maryland, that dealt with radiation type of burns, usually from the fallout of nuclear attacks. And they were the ones to diagnose with XP.
So,
but it was the last condition to be checked, and that's what she had.
So, do you know how many people approximately have XP?
I know in the U.S. that it's like one out of a million. We know of about 130 cases. There statistically should be about 250. But these are the ones that we know and who have contacted us and who have found some kind of support. Throughout the world, I think they're guessing it's about 3,000 people, and most of them are in Japan. But they're in every country that you can imagine, and in some countries there might be only one child with it in the whole entire country. It's so extremely rare that it's hard to gather the people, the support, the resources necessary to do research for them.
So, in your time running Camp Sundown and providing opportunities for these kids, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Actually, there are a lot of success stories, not necessarily the ones we started wanting. We were hoping the success story would be a cure, and that doesn't look like it's anywhere in the process. The success stories seem to be the bonding and the immediate friendships and support that's gathered by people sharing a common condition. And that is magical when that happens and people are sitting around the dining room table and saying, oh, yeah, this happened to my child and this is what we did. People helping each other get through what's going to be a life crisis. That's the magical part.
So are there any treatments you're aware of for these conditions?
Right now, because XP presents itself with hundreds of skin and eye cancers that require surgeries, grafting, corneal transplants, chemical treatments, we basically right now are responding to the cancer as it comes up. What we can do before the cancer comes up is preventative measures. But other than that, other than blocking the light out and dealing with life adaptively, there isn't anything except to conquer the cancers as they come. But no immediate research breakthrough.
So if you could send any one message to the community about this condition and the need for greater awareness, what would you say?
I would say that for all rare diseases, and XP falls into that very easily. Actually, that's a very difficult question. I think the need for funding is just, it's obvious. There is such a need for funding. And sometimes when you have a condition that's so rare, the answer to that condition may be an answer that will help the whole population. Skin cancer's epidemic. If they help solve that for XP by finding out what causes XP to happen, they can help millions of people who are diagnosed with skin cancer every day.
Like,
so supporting research. One of our biggest goals right now, because we don't see research happening to solve a cure for Katie in her lifetime, is to look at the quality of life of these families. These kids live in isolation during the daytime. When they go out to play at night, all their friends are already in bed. It's a cruel disease for a child. And I think understanding that and being open to that and realizing that if you do see a child that's covered up with blankets and tinting and all sorts of things, that maybe they aren't a space creature, maybe they actually are a person with a condition, and to be more open to asking questions and accepting information as opposed to making things up.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
So, do you have anything coming up in regards to XP and just opportunities for community engagement?
Actually, we've got two events coming up. One is a camp, again, in October. from October 11th to the 14th. And kids, again, come from all over the world. We have a lot of Canadian families that come to Camp Sundown. Also, we post all the time the pictures of the camp as they're happening so that people can feel connected. There's opportunities to donate through the website. And then we also have an event called a golf ball drop, which is happening at the end of October, and that's also on our website at www.xps.org.
Thank you very much. In this next segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Audrey McFarlane, who will be telling us a little bit about fetal alcohol syndrome. So tell me a little bit about FASTI.
So fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is a condition that's the result of prenatal alcohol exposure to the developing fetus. It can occur in a range of disabilities for individuals. So those things that might be impairments to the brain that are very mild, like a learning disability, to very significant across many parts of the brain. So there's lots of factors that might go into that. A woman's health, her diet, any other trauma experiences that she might be having. So there's lots of genetics even. So there's lots of things that can impact the effects of the alcohol on the developing baby.
So can you tell me a little bit about your organization's work in regards to this?
Right. So I'm with the Canada FASD Research Network, which is a unique research network in that we bring together all the stakeholders involved, so individuals with FASD, their families, government policy people, service providers, and then with the researchers as well to look at specific topics that are important to people. So, for example, last year we had a big symposium where we brought all these folks together to talk about what does housing look like for adults with FASD and what are the successes and the challenges in housing people with this disorder and what kinds of things did they need. And from that, we were able to then look at all the literature and the work and focus our outcomes to developing a framework that governments can use when they're looking at funding in that area. So there's lots of different projects that we focus in on around diagnosis and screening, assessment, to different types of interventions for folks, to justice best practices, to child welfare best practices. So there's a whole gamut of things that we're interested in doing, but not so much the biosciences or the epigenetic kinds of things. We're more interested in the applied sciences.
So are there any challenges in putting together frameworks and best practices for those affected?
Well, services are often not designed for this population. So there are housing services for people with disabilities and housing services for folks that are living on the street or have mental health issues, but not specifically for folks with FASD. And so their challenges can be somewhat different than other disabilities. They may have been diagnosed much later in life. They may have had a very unsupported childhood in that people didn't understand the condition that they had, and so the right services and supports weren't put around them. So they've already started down a path that's not that healthy or not as interested in accepting specialized services. So it can be very challenging to support these folks and get them on a great path in life. We do find now that folks or children that have been diagnosed 10, 15 years ago and people understand about their condition start to put the right supports in place when they're little, that they have a much better outcome in life and are much more productive than folks that have been diagnosed later.
So, to look at the converse side of things, in your time with the research group, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Yes, for sure. There are quite a few things that Canada as a country can be quite proud of. So in 2005, Canada developed the first FASD diagnostic guidelines. And then 10 years later, we updated those guidelines and really moved away, made a bold move to develop guidelines that were specific to the evidence that we knew about at that time. And so Canada is one of the few countries in the world that has diagnostic guidelines. And then from there, we've developed a national database. So as people are getting diagnosed in Canada, with their permission, of course, information is being collected anonymously about them and goes into this national database so we can learn more about folks, the challenges that they have, the services that are available to them, and hopefully we can use that information to better understand, to continue to refine the diagnostic process, and to give governments information about what kinds of services that they need. So that is the only database in the world, and so that's that comprehensive, that collects real time information about people. So those are some pretty big accomplishments that the CanFASD Research Network and Canada have been able to put together. So those are real standout moments for me.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
This is Joe and Cam, your favorite two male nursing students at the University of Windsor, hosting No Scrubs on CJAM FM 99.1.
Join me and Joe every Tuesday at 12 and Wednesday at 4:30, where we discuss today's hottest health topics related to student life. We do the research, so you don't have to.
Remember, you can listen live or online at www.cjam.ca. And while you're at it, feel free to give us a follow at CJAM No Scrubs on Facebook.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Audrey McFarlane about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder and Karen Mahar about Camp Sundown. Duplication Cares.
Okay, well, Duplication Cares is an organization that supports individuals and families who are impacted by 7q11.23 duplication syndrome. And I know that sounds like a mouthful, but there is another syndrome called Williams syndrome, and it is a deletion of the chromosome in that same area. And that's a more well-known duplication or a more well-known syndrome. And so when our folks or our family members started to get diagnosed with the same area, which is a duplication, there wasn't any support. I know when my son, Jackson, was diagnosed, I was given one sheet of paper, and the geneticist said, you know, this is all we know about this duplication syndrome, and, you know, good luck. And so as all of us have started to come together, we've been able to form this support group for families that are diagnosed with the duplication syndrome, and we have, you know, been able to build relationships with researchers and families across the world. And so the mission of Duplication Cares is to help these family members not only understand information that's available to them, but also to bring support and awareness to this rare chromosome duplication.
So how does the duplication typically affect a person?
You know, it can be a little bit different for every single person. I like to think of it as a spectrum, a lot like the autism spectrum disorder. That doesn't mean to say that every single person with the duplication has autism. That's not true. They don't. However, some of them do have autism, but the duplication is a spectrum. There's some people who don't have a great, that are not greatly impacted by the duplication, and there's others who are more significant. So some of the things that that might look like in an individual would be, of course, there's some facial features. As I compare pictures with of my son with other children, they have similar facial features, but it also impacts expressive language. So they might hear what you're saying and understand what you're saying, but they might not be able to express language easily. For a lot of kids, language is delayed significantly. Extensive speech therapy is required. I know that my son didn't have, you know, very many words until probably the age of 5. Behavior is another challenge for a lot of kids. Anxiety is huge. And so, you know, if people think about anxiety, they think, oh, you know, it might be, you know, worrying about, you know, a test at school or something like this or something like that. But in our case, with our children who have the duplication, it's intensified. So it could be, you know, a room full of people, like social anxiety, or, you know, not, they have something set in their mind about the way things are supposed to go. And if it didn't go that way, then it's a total meltdown because of the anxiety around that situation. It could be, you know, social interactions are really challenging. Social relationships are challenging. A lot of the kids have a hard time with making and keeping friends. You know, learning can be impacted, cognitive ability, hypotonia, low muscle tone, developmental delay, global developmental delay, whether it's physical or cognitive. Intellectual abilities differ. That's where that spectrum comes in. A lot of the kids have a wide range of ability cognitively and with school and how they interact with school. One of the most important characteristics that people should be aware of is the cardiac condition. Our kids are prone to aortic dilation, and so they have echocardiograms every 6 months to 2 years, depending upon the child, but that can be life-threatening. So we really want people who are impacted by the duplication to understand about the cardiac challenges associated with it. And also seizure disorders have been associated with it. You know, just a couple of other things that are not as common, but those are kind of the main areas of focus.
So do you know offhand about how many people are affected by this duplication?
People are being diagnosed all of the time. I think it's best to take a look at history. When the genome was mapped, that's the first time they were able to really diagnose this duplication, is with a blood test called CGH microarray. And through a blood test, you can look at all of your DNA and see if there's any deletions or duplications with your chromosomes. And before that test was developed, you know, you had to test specifically for a syndrome, whether it was Smith-Magenis or Fragile X or whatever it was. And so once that test came about and people started testing for genetic syndromes, more and more people have been diagnosed. So when my son was diagnosed when he was about 7 years old, he's now 19, he was about the 11th in the world diagnosed. And now there's more and more coming to us every week. We get, you know, a handful of families contacting us each week. I think the estimates are about 1 in 10,000 will be impacted by this duplication. And again, it's not Williams syndrome. A lot of people, when they're diagnosed, are given the diagnoses of, you know, Williams syndrome duplication, and it's not. It's completely opposite from Williams syndrome. Williams syndrome children are more social. Their cognitive function is lower. And our children, and they have great, you know, speech. And our children struggle with speech. Social is huge for them. We're completely opposite because the DNA is so different. It's really, really quite interesting when you take a look at it.
So, in your time with Duplication Cares, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Oh, sure. You know, I think two things come to mind. One is helping a parent. They receive the diagnosis. They're totally lost. They don't know anybody that's ever had this. They don't have a point of reference. They don't know what their child's future will look like. They're not sure if their child will ever talk. Will they be able to go to school? Will they, you know, go to college? Will they be married? You know, all of these kind of dreams that you have for your child, and you're just not sure what the future is going to look like. And so when they come in contact with Duplication Cares, we're able to throw them that lifeline, and we're able to give them the information they need to, you know, kind of reground themselves and say, okay, this is what the future is going to look like, you know, as far as we can tell. It might be a little bit different than you thought it was going to look like, but your child can still be successful and happy, and these are the tools that you need to help that child find their path. And I think the second accomplishment that we're really proud of is last summer in 2018, we took the organization to Washington, D.C., and we had our first annual conference. And to let you know the scope of that and what an accomplishment that was, this started with a handful of moms. There was about four or five of us that just kind of found out about each other and started this support group. And then another mom came on board and actually formalized the organization and made us into Duplication Cares. And we grew from this handful of moms who are concerned about their children to an international organization that is literally bringing people from Australia and Israel and all across the United States into this coalition of parents who want to make sure that our children are the pioneers and that other families don't have to go through what we've been through, fighting for answers and therapy and figuring out next steps for our kids. And this conference in Washington, D.C. was huge for us because not only were families able to interact and be together and actually see other children who are just like them, but we were also able to bring together all of the key researchers, the cardiologists and the developmental specialists and psychiatrists and people from NIH, the National Institute of Health in the United States, and you know all of these key researchers who know the most about the duplication and give the information to families firsthand. Our next conference will be held in Salt Lake City, Utah, in July of 2020, and so we hope families will join us there for another fabulous conference. But that's our mission, is to get information out to families. You know, families every day go to their doctor, to their primary care physician or a specialist, and the families end up knowing more about the duplication than the doctors, and we want to change that. We want families to have more resources and more support, and that's our goal, and we're making it happen day by day.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. Today's interviews really spoke to me, folks, but when it comes to the one on fetal alcohol spectrum, I gotta ask the question, why? Why would anyone take the risk? It's your life to risk, that's true, but your child who's developing is innocent and has no say in the matter. It's not like they can tell you, no, don't drink a quart of gin, it might hurt me later. They don't know the world that way, but anyone taking on the responsibility of being a parent should know this. It's not worth it for a moment of enjoyment to result in a lifetime of supportive care in some cases. The child deserves better. Yeah, you might encounter a situation where you have your first child, they're fine, you did some high-risk behaviors, and by the grace of God and all the good in the universe, they came out okay. Doesn't mean it's going to happen that way again. Don't gamble with these innocent lives. Fact is, no one asks to have a disability. No one asks to have a condition given to them without their consent. The truth is, we have no right to make that decision for anyone, whether they're just entering the world or whether they've made their mark over the course of decades. It's a simple thing. Just be careful. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.